somebody help, not just anybody help. You know I need someone help.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Real Recovery. This is Bill Arnold with George Fraser tonight. We are the two sweaty, insecure guys behind the bacon-flavored microphones. How are you, George?
Bill, I'm ready to go. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. You work twice as hard for half the credit, but I still appreciate what you do here, George.
It's your show, Bill. Just glad to be here.
Yeah. So I can see neither of us sent our stunt doubles tonight.
No. No, we showed up tonight.
We showed up tonight. We have in the past sent stunt doubles, but not tonight, because the show is too big tonight.
We got a great show.
It's too big. Let me tell you what's on board, and we've got a special surprise, two special surprises. That's all we have of surprises tonight, George.
Special ones, Bill.
Special. We have with us coming up later in the hour, we're going to be welcoming to the program the Reverend Dr. Glenn Pickering. Glenn has written two books about the game he calls tag. The game that he says is the cause of every sort of addictive behavior. Does that fit into our program or what?
Where were you 30 years ago, Glenn?
It would have been nice had he been more available to you back in your days.
It would have been. I'm just really glad he's here tonight. We have somebody else, too, don't we?
Yes, well, we have a very, very, very special guest tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm almost choking up right here, George.
I can see it.
Seriously, I'm starting to mist up. Do you want to go ahead and talk about it? Because I could break down.
I'm too choked up right now, Bill.
You're choked up too?
Yeah.
All right, then I guess I'll be the man step forward here.
Ouch.
We have with us tonight Alex.
Alex is here.
Alex, yeah. Alex usually is here. He's here every week.
Did he have to do anything tonight to save the program?
No, actually, he came in and everything was perfect.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Which was a first.
Well, it is a first. But you know what makes that so nice is it took a lot of stress off him and took a lot of pressure off him and gave him an opportunity to think about what he's going to share with us tonight, because Alex is going to talk about a little bit about his story tonight.
Can't wait to hear that.
Well, I can't. Let's not waste any more time, because I'm bored of you.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the feelings are mutual.
Yeah. Let's go to it.
Let's get started. Okay, George, ask the first question.
So, Alex.
Yes.
It's good to see you, first of all.
Thank you.
What did you want to share with our audience tonight?
Well, a year and a half ago, actually, it was January 23rd, and it was around 1 a.m., so January 23rd, January 24th, and I woke up with just a terrible headache, and I don't know how to describe it except this is not a good description, but this is the best I can do. It was kind of like a lightning bolt down the left side of my face with like shards of glass in it. Like, it was just terrible. It was the most terrible thing I've ever felt. Really, well, one of them. But for whatever reason, I thought, oh, headache, this is not good. So I was headed, obviously, it was 1 a.m. I was kind of in and out of sleep. So I got up. I kind of thought I'd just shake it off. So I tried to go back to sleep after that and realized that I was just sweating really badly. I was like, well, this isn't normal. And so I got up, wiped my face off, ended up laying down on the floor to try to cool off. The headache's not going away. I realized that things were starting to get blurry and spinning around a little bit. And went to grab a glass of water off of my desk. I was in my room at the time when all this was happening. And so grabbed a glass of water, took a drink, realized that it didn't go down, that it got caught in my throat. And so I thought I was choking, actually. So I finally, and at this point, I was starting to get weak in my left side. And so I kind of pulled myself up, and my roommate, I live with three roommates, we are a three-room apartment. One of my roommates is right next door to me there. His door is right outside of mine. No one was actually supposed to be home that night. One of my buddies was out. I don't know what he was doing. He was gone, though. David said he wouldn't be home that night, but for whatever reason, David was home that night, and I knew it, so I swung my door open, and I'm knocking on David's door. It's 1 a.m., so he's asleep. He thought I was hanging a picture at 1 a.m. He said later, he's like, what, why in the world? Because he was sleeping, obviously, so just in his hazy state, he's thinking, why is he doing this at 1 a.m.? But finally, when I knew he was up, I opened the door and said, David, you have to take me to the hospital. Well, he called 911, and so I got ready to go to the hospital. In the middle of getting ready to go to the hospital, getting dressed, that's when I lost all I mean, I couldn't stand up. Everything on my left side just kind of went dead, and I fell into the wall and fell into a lamp and couldn't stand up. So anyway, the ambulance comes. David goes down to greet them. There's a call. Our apartment is on the far side of the apartment building. The call box is in the middle of our apartment building. No one ever uses the call box except tonight. And when they use the call box, it goes to my phone. So, of course, I pick up the phone. It's the paramedics. I can't really talk because I've got this water stuck in my throat. And I think I said something like, "Oh, my roommate's coming to find you." So while David's downstairs getting the paramedics, I am trying to hold myself up onto the wall of my hallway to make my way down the hallway. Flop onto the love seat. The paramedics get in there. I can't stand up. I don't know what's going on. They don't know what's going on. Long story short, they have to carry me down the stairs, onto a stretcher, into an ambulance, and they take me to Regents Hospital in St. Paul. So at this point, I'm in the hospital. David calls my folks. My parents show up. And all of this that's going on, obviously they're running tests. They're trying to figure out what exactly it is. They don't think it's a stroke, so they kind of rule that out. But the whole time I have this water in my throat, and finally someone says, I think it's my mom who says, "Can we get him something to get that water out of his throat?" So anyway, long story short, I can't swallow. From there on, it's all kind of a blur. I'm sure my mom or dad or somebody else, David, who was there, could kind of tell you what happened. But I do know, you know, they basically just ran tests all night. Put me in the ICU. The next morning, they do find out, indeed, it was a stroke. Mm-hmm. And it was in the brainstem. And so no strength on the left side of my body. Can't stand up. Can't swallow. Everything's blurry. The room is spinning constantly. And so that's where I am in the ICU of Regents Hospital. And so I spent about, altogether, I was in Regents for 16 days. I can't remember exactly how long I was in the ICU, but then I was moved over to the rehab unit. After a few days, they figured out, okay, well, he can't swallow. So they had to put a feeding tube in through my nose. And then after a few more days of that, they realized, well, this is going to be longer than just a couple of days of him not being able to swallow. Just to throw it out there, the actual term is called Wallenberg syndrome, and it's something that happens in the brainstem that causes you not to be able to swallow anything.
Did you feel like you were drowning?
I mean, a little bit. In the hospital, they had to have one of those, you know, like if you go to the dentist and there's the, you know, they do the teeth clean and mm-hmm. they put in the suction.
I would know about that. George wouldn't, but
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, and they put in the suction thing and to suck everything out. I had to live with one of those for 3 months.
Oh, boy.
And so in the hospital, there was just always one by my bed. When I finally got out of the hospital, I literally for 3 months carried around. I don't know. It was probably, you know, it was a machine. It was like, it was about the size of a car battery, and there was a strap on it, and there was a little hose on it. And so I couldn't swallow. So anytime I would need to suction, I would. It was, mm-hmm. it sounded like a vacuum. So you couldn't go in public anywhere. And when you did, it was embarrassing. So that's where that was. Spent some time. So I was there in the ICU, went through rehab, was finally able to get out of the rehab after 16 days, and then it was basically just kind of a 3 month journey. Went 99 days without eating anything. They had to put a feeding tube in my stomach. There's still, I like to tell people, I have a second belly button because there's a scar there from where it used to be. And
like a James Bond thing.
Yeah. So I just was on formula for 99 days and. And then finally was able to swallow again. It just kind of happened. In hindsight, because I had a lot of different, I had a physical therapist, I had a, what they call it, occupational therapist, I had a speech therapist, and the speech therapist, his name was Evan, and he said at one point, this was after the fact, he obviously didn't tell me this while it was happening, but he said he wasn't really, he had his doubts sometimes that I was going to be able to swallow again. But then just one day, it was kind of gross, but I burped. And I hadn't burped in 3 months. And so I walked out. I lived with my parents during this time. I lived, stayed in their basement just because they were taking care of me. And so I walked upstairs and asked my mom. I said, I don't think I've burped in 3 months, right? And she's like, no. So that's when I knew things were starting to turn. And literally went from 0 to 60 because within a day or two I could eat again. But yeah, 99 days without it. So.
Well, your real recovery started with a burp.
Yeah, yeah.
So where did you find yourself spiritually in all this? Were you panicked? Were you crying out to God? Were you calm? Were you
mad? I don't think I was panicked. I don't think I was mad. A lot of the times, you know, countless conversations about this, but my family feels like, you know, there's really just this thing, whatever it was, there's this survival thing that kicks in where you just want to make it through another day, and you're not mad, you're not necessarily, I mean, I was sad, obviously, but it's just more so, let's just get through today. And I know that every morning I would wake up, and when I could finally stand again and shower by myself, I would stand in the shower and just pray and say, God, let today be the day. And, you know, it took 99 days for that to happen. For me to be able to swallow again, you know, and everybody, that's the million-dollar question then is, well, what did you learn, or what was the experience, or what was the takeaway? Mm-hmm. And, you know, well, don't have a stroke, first of all.
I'll do the comedy, Alex, yeah. In the show. Don't you think, George?
I think so. That's good, though.
But during this time, this blog post came out from John Piper, and he was talking about when he had his cancer, and it all boils down to this one, and I'm paraphrasing here, and this is just this isn't exactly what he says, but it was more or less to the effect of there are a thousand reasons why God is doing what he's doing right now, but I only need to know one, and that's to rely more. He's teaching me to rely more on the God who raises the dead. And so even a year and a half, more than a year and a half removed from the situation, I still kind of shrug my shoulders and say, I don't know. But I have that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's enough for now.
And I think on that we'll take a little brief pause.
Thanks, Alex.
Alex, this is a great story, and I love hearing where God took you through your journey. And we're going to hear a little bit more when we come back, and then we're going to have Dr. Glenn Pickering with us. You are listening to Real Recovery on Faith Radio. This is Bill Arnold with George Fraser. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold here with George Fraser. George and I have been having a humility contest this week, and I know in my heart that I'm winning. I know that.
You should.
Yeah, no, I know in my heart.
You should win this one, Bill.
No, I know. But we're talking to our producer and board operator, Alex, who's really shared quite a fascinating story to have had a stroke at such a young age.
Well, he's a radio guy too, Bill. And what if he can't talk anymore?
If you can't talk, you lose your pipes, you're out of work.
Ouch.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff we can
lose. You
know,
he's not old like we are.
No, but that's, he's very young.
I mean, you could
young.
Be his grandfather, but, you know, he's a young guy.
Not grandfather, George. Father, not grandfather.
Out to break, we'll do the math.
All right. But, Alex, I mean, you put a nice button on that story, and that you were going to just follow God each day and say, I'm going to just try to get through today.
Yeah, I mean, that makes it sound like it was easy or nice or whatever. But it really was very difficult. You know, you bring up that point, George, about not being able to talk again. And yeah, and my voice was messed up that whole time. It's still, every now and then my voice will still crack, and that's some of the residual left over from that. One of the cool stories, though, that happened, I mean, this is just one of those cool little connect things. At the time, I was working at a radio station with PK, who does the morning show here now. And, you know, so I was at the morning show there. I had, obviously, I was in the hospital, so he couldn't show up. So PK took over, and so she was talking about, oh, well, this happened to Alex. And one of my doctors, Dr. Kate Venable, was driving into work one day, and she was listening to that radio station, and she just thought, well, I have an Alex in the hospital. What a great reminder to pray for him. Well, the next day she heard PK talking about it again, and so finally she came in and asked my parents and said, is that the Alex, the one I'm hearing about on the radio? Like, yeah, that's the one. So my doctor, who was taking care of me, was also a listener. And so that was just one of those cool connect points, knowing that, you know, the things, you know, were crazy, but there was, you know, somehow, some way things were going to be connected and okay and work out maybe. So.
Well, we absolutely love working with you, and we look forward to seeing you every week, and I love hearing your story. I mean, honestly, George, I've not heard this story in its entirety.
I hadn't heard it, Bill. One of the things
I knew he had a stroke, but that was it.
Yeah. One of the things, Alex, is you were on a real solid walk with Jesus before this happened, and I think, you know, you hear that with, just help me to get through today.
Yeah.
You know, don't worry about tomorrow, for each day has enough trouble of its own, and what an encouraging story. You're a great guy, and I'm glad you're back to health, and that would have been very scary. It would be for me right now, Bill.
And how nice to have a loving, supportive family.
Absolutely.
Because a lot of people who are in a recovery position sometimes don't have that alongside them. So thank you, Mom and Dad, and thank you, Jody, for all your prayers and support. And I know it made a huge difference in his life.
Yep. Good job, Alex.
Thanks,
yeah,
Alex.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, George, step eight.
Step eight,
Step
Bill.
Eight.
We
what
made
is
a,
it?
We made a list of all people we had harmed and became willing to make the, amends to them all. And then, of course, we roll into step nine, where we made direct amends to people, except when to do so would injure them or others. As you know, here on Real Recovery, every week we take one or two of the 12 steps. And the difference here between Real Recovery and a 12-step program is our higher power is Jesus Christ, who is the highest power. And, of course, we look at it, as we're going to talk to Glenn about. If you don't have Jesus in your recovery, you don't have recovery. We believe that idolatry is the cause of all our addictions, and recovery without Jesus Christ is still idolatry. So when we look at these, Bill, it's not just about, you know, our acts of omission or commission against people that we did or didn't do that we could have done, but I think we also have to look at, okay, if we made a decision in step three to turn our will and our life over to the care of Jesus, I want to have a living amend for him. It's not like we're giving him anything that he's not due, but we got a second chance, some of us a third, fourth, fifth chance. I want to live my life for Jesus. And as you always tell me, George, if Jesus is going to be your Savior, he has to be Lord over all areas of your life, not just your drug and addiction. So that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, we sometimes look more at our sin than our Savior. I think it's important to look at our Savior. And we're so happy to have with us tonight the Reverend Dr. Glenn Pickering. Glenn has written two books about the game he calls tag, the game that he says is the cause of every sort of addiction. And, George, you're holding up a copy of one of the books. And we've got three books that we're willing to give away tonight on the program. If you'd like to be a caller and be a part of tonight's show, you can do that by calling 1-877-933-2484. That's 1-877-93-FAITH. If you want me to spell it out. Anyway, the tag game is the cause of every sort of addictive behavior. So, Dr. Pickering, what do you mean by that?
Well, thank you.
And welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I like being here. Well, let me talk just very briefly about the game of tag and then why I think it's the driver of all addictive behaviors. I came to understand that us adults, we play a game a lot like that little kid game of tag where, you know, you're running around and trying not to be it. And just like kids who they either use passive strategies where they stay away from everybody so they don't get tagged, so they create distance, or if they do get tagged, then they want to chase after somebody else and tag them. So I think of that as sort of the active strategies of the game and the passive strategies, the things we do to not be it in the first place, the things we do to tag others once we are it. And you'll see in adult relationships that we do the same thing, that all of our forms of wrong relationship are just a way to play tag. So I want all of you to think about this. When was the last time you were at a meeting and you had something you knew that would be helpful, but you didn't say it? because you didn't want to be wrong, or you didn't want to be criticized, or you didn't want to look foolish? Or what's the last time somebody asked you where you wanted to go out to dinner with a group of you, and you said, oh, I don't care, whatever you guys want, it's fine? All ways of not showing up. Those are passive ways to not be it, not be criticized, not get judged, not be the bad one. And then I want to think, you got to think of the last time that somebody was critical of you or judgmental of you, and how fast you were to defend yourself, to blame somebody else, and to make somebody else it. That's all. That's the active way to play the adult version of the game of tag. Okay, so here's how that all relates to addictions. Both of those ways to play tag, whether I keep people silently at a distance by what I don't do, or whether I lash out and drive them away by being blameful and defending, either way, what I do is create distance in relationships. I'm in wrong relationship. And I promise you that lack of relationship with God and with others creates a hole in us that's so big and so painful that we would fill it up with anything we can get our hands on. And so an addiction is just an attempt to get just enough alcohol, enough drugs, enough women, enough prestige, enough money, enough attention, enough something to fill that hole. And so it's like every addiction is a search for an external answer to an internal problem.
Mm. I like that a lot, Bill.
I'm taking notes, George.
You should.
So I can't even...
That wasn't the passive one there. That was aggressive, wasn't it? I just tagged you because it made me feel better.
Yeah.
Right. To put you down.
Right. Temporarily.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have another one later, so when that wears off. But is that how it fits, though, Doctor?
Yes. So here's how it fits. So what happens then, if a person comes out of that tag-playing family, tag-playing sort of background, so what they've done is they've learned to create a lot of distance in their relationship. It creates that gap in them, like I say, that we just have to fill with something. And the reason that every 12-step group has this one thing in common relates back to what I just said. The one thing that every 12-step group has in common is that it's a group. It's a place where you do relationship. So here's all these people who are lacking relationship with one another and with God. They come to this community whose one goal is to help them learn how to create relationships with God and with one another. Every one of the 12 steps is either about being back in right relationship with our Lord or back in right relationship with one another. And so I always say the opposite of every addiction is intimacy. And I always think, so until we really learn to get our relationships right, we'll always struggle with compulsive or addictive relationships or addictive behaviors of one sort or another.
Is that a good thing, or has it become a substitute that could become dangerous?
What's that?
When you start to fill community of outside groups, when you're having struggle with your primary relationships and the isolation because you're maybe playing tag actively or passively, and then you're in another kind of group.
Right. And I think one of the great things about amends, so this actually is a great lead into step 8 and 9. Thank you. So a person goes to a group, let's say a 12-step group, and they feel like, okay, here in this place, I can tell my story while you listen, you tell your story while I listen. In this group, I'm starting to learn what it looks like to be in right relationship with other people. I put my real self out there. They put their real self out there. I'm starting to get that. Amends are always saying, great, now go do it with everybody else. Now step outside the group. Be in right relationship with all those other people in your life who keep waiting for the real you to show up.
Okay, but if I'm going to do that with other people,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be successful, I have to do that with God first, right?
Oh, that's so true.
Yeah.
And here's how come, which is why what you'll notice is, remember I said, every 12-step program, it really teaches two things, how to be in right relationship with God and right relationship with other people. And so any 12-step group is like a little laboratory. It's like, okay, I got to get my relationship right with God. And I had to learn how to do that with other people. So now, if I'm going to go outside the group, I have some sense of how it is that a person would go about bringing God into a different kind of relationship.
The scary thing about these things for me, Bill, is just like my relationship with God, relationship with other people isn't on my terms. And that's scary.
Right. Yep, I think always I can either have other people's approval or I can have their love, but I can't have them both. And as a former approval addict, I really get this. See, if I need people's approval, then I pretend to be somebody who I think they will like, thinking that then they will pat me on the back, and I'm kind of in control of that. And they'll pat me on the back, and then I'll feel better about myself. But here's the really, really painful lie of that. Let's say I pretend to be somebody else. And then people pat me in the back and say, Glenn, you're such a great guy. What do I actually think inside?
Imposter.
Right, if you knew the real me. And so I get all that approval, thinking that then I'll feel better about myself. But all it does is make me aware.
Okay, now does
that they don't know the real me.
That goes back then to I can't get anything from something other than God that I can only get from God, right? Other people can't fill that.
Well, here's the thing. It's actually God and other people. And, well, let me back up just a second. Do we have a minute before we go to break, or is it okay to?
Yep, we've got a minute.
Okay. They're actually the same thing. When the scriptures say that God is love, and then Paul in Colossians 3 is trying to wrestle with that, like, what does that mean? So he talks about some of the characteristics of love, and then finally he says, love is that which binds together all living things. So the love that connects my heart to your heart is God, which is why then in 1 John 4:20 it says, anybody who says they love God but hates his brother or sister is a liar and the truth is not in him. I don't get it. If I say I love God but I don't honor the connection I have between me and you, I don't know what I'm talking about.
I want to spend some time on that one, Bill. I think that affects all of us there.
That's a huge one. I think we should just take a very short break. I want to remind our listeners tonight, we've got 3 copies of Dr. Pickering's book, Tag, available to callers tonight. So
2, Bill. I just took one.
George took one, so we're now down to 2. I'll probably take one, so we'll be down to 1. And if, Alex, you take one, don't bother calling in. This is Real Recovery. Be back in a minute on Faith Radio. Thanks, everybody, for still listening. If you are, in fact, with us still, this is Bill Arnold with George Fraser on Real Recovery, and we're talking tonight to Dr. Glenn Pickering. And if you want to be part of tonight's show, I was just kind of joking about those books. We still have a couple to give out. And if you'd like to call in and be a guest on the show with a question or a comment, you can certainly do that, 1-877-933-2484, 1-877. So, George, you had a question right as we were signing off for break for Dr. Pickering. What is that again?
Well, we were talking about the scripture that talks about Dr. Pickering, about if I say I love God who I can't see and I don't love people that I do see, that doesn't work. And for a lot of us, that's hard.
Right.
So how do we improve that?
I think this to myself all the time. Somebody asked me a while back after I gave a talk somewhere about whether I found the scriptures inspiring. And I said, no, they scare me witless. Because they're so challenging. So the Pharisees come to Jesus. They, you know, ask him, what's the great commandment? And he cheats, of course. It seems like, and gets them to, you know, love your God, love your neighbor as yourself. Because, see, he understood the same thing I just said to you. They're inseparable. You can't do one without the other one. So then the Pharisees, see, they understand already how hard this will be. And so they say, well, who is my neighbor? Hoping for a loophole of some sort. Maybe it's just the 2 people who live right next door to me. And Jesus tells them the story we call the Good Samaritan, which we think, oh, that's a good story, a sweet story. But I think there's nothing sweet about it. It was incredibly confrontative. Jesus was trying to say, who is your neighbor? Every gall-dang person God sends to you, including the ones you can't stand. Oh, wow. So we're called to love everyone we meet, everyone that God brings into our life. And if that's not a challenge for you, you're not paying attention.
So we're supposed to love people that don't do what we want, don't right. do what we like, and aren't nice to us, too.
Right. It turns out they have their own life.
George, how would you consider, how do you treat people who are sort of anonymous to you in a way? You know, like clerks or a wait staff or repair people.
Or you.
Or me, yeah. You know.
I like to, one of the things I got from my dad was to treat everybody equally. And some days with me, that can be equally poorly. Some days it can be very loving. But consistently, I try to treat everybody the same.
Yeah.
But do I do that? No. I think sometimes, Bill, you know, you can look at where you're at spiritually is how you treat people that can't do anything for you.
Okay. I'm tuning you out because I have another question for Dr. Pickering.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you going to answer that one?
No. I was just going to ask you, and then you got kind of winded, so
I thought,
you're boring me. Now I want to ask him something.
Okay.
Let's talk about amends and how they can be straightforward and why people struggle so much with amends. How about, I broke it, I'll fix it. I stole it, I'll pay for it or return it. I lied, so I need to tell you the truth.
Right.
So we struggle.
Here's why we struggle, and here's why it's so important. So thank you for asking that. Those are core questions. We struggle because, see, all of us, whether we want to admit it or not, come out of that tag-playing background. And in tag, see, if I admit I made a mistake, I did it wrong, I messed up, I was incorrect, I did something stupid, that means I'm going to get criticized, I'm going to get judged, I'm going to get controlled, I'm going to be made fun of, I'm going to be it. And the whole game is about not being it. So I go around, I either deny that I made mistakes, you know, and denial is a big part of that whole addictive process, or if somebody points it out to the point where I really can't even deny it, then I defend, I explain, I blame it on somebody else, I rationalize, I do those attacking things where I make it somebody else's fault. Because it's so scary to just stand in the truth, yes, I made a mistake. Because I believe the consequences are going to be so destructive to me. Now, here's why it's so important that we do go about it. Remember I said that amends is how we take the experience of the 12-step group and bring it to the larger world. And here's what we will always discover. I was talking to my great aunt years and years ago. She's an amazing woman, inside and out. We're sitting at lunch, and she said, Glenn, I like you so much better now. Wasn't quite sure where to go with that. And I looked a little surprised, I'm sure. And she said, oh, I didn't mean anything bad by that. She said, I've always really liked you. I've always admired you. I've always looked up to you. But if it's always been like you're this stainless steel ball with no seams, perfectly polished. Couldn't find a way in. But she says, now you talk so much about your mistakes, about the things you're learning. You ask me questions. You seek my advice. You talk about your struggles. And now it's so much easier for me to find a way in. Mm-hmm. And she taught me this really valuable thing. We connect on the level of our struggles. We connect on the level of our struggles. Therefore, why is it that I have to make amends to the people in my life outside of the group? Because, see, that's the only way I'm actually going to connect to them. Because what I'm going to find out is we connect on the level of our struggles. They're actually going to understand we're going to have a connection, and I'm actually going to be back in right relationship with the people who I've been in a wrong relationship with all my life.
So don't a lot of people in 12-step programs connect on their brokenness?
Right. But see, here's the thing. We all have the same brokenness. We all have the same struggles. If you had to list, you know, the 8 struggles that you went through in your life and what you've learned from the beginning and what you're learning now and what you still need to learn, I promise you'd be the same 8 things for everybody else. So we like to pretend we're different. I was leading a men's retreat one time years ago with like 34 guys, and I was trying to talk to them about how we really do connect on the level of our struggles. We have very similar struggles. And I could see there wasn't one guy in the group who was buying it. I mean, I was literally losing the group right in front of my eyes. So I thought, I might as well stop because this is going nowhere. So I asked each of them to write down one thing about them that was so bad that made them so different from everybody else in that group that they wouldn't even ever want to say it out loud. And they all wrote something down. Then I asked them all to share them. There was kind of a long pause in that room, as you might guess. So one guy very bravely said, Glenn, I struggle with pornography. I said, you know, thanks for sharing. So I said to the 34 guys in that room, now how many of you ever looked at pornography, been tempted to look at pornography, had a sexual thought about somebody other than your wife, had bad feelings about yourself sexually in some way, did something sexually inappropriate that you feel bad about? How many of those 34 guys do you think raised their hand?
35?
Right.
Including the...
So it's important to understand those things that we think separate us are exactly what actually connect us, which is why if we're willing to talk about our struggles, it's actually not a way to push people away from us. It's not a way to be shameful. It's a way to give people the chance to actually connect with our real self.
And that's about the last thing we want to do is find ourselves in a position where we're feeling judged or criticized by people, because at the end of the day, don't we all want to be liked?
Well, I think there's another piece here too, guys. If we're all alike, then we're not terminally unique either.
Right, which is what the first thing is. They try and disabuse you of in group. It's like how many guys have come back to the first group? And I said, how did it go? And they said, Glenn, it was amazing. And I said, yeah, what was amazing about it? There are people there just like me.
Uh-huh.
Guess what? Everywhere you go, there are people just like you.
Yeah, I'm glad we have a caller. Actually,
okay, great.
On line two, welcome to the program.
Hi. I heard Mr. Pickering speak a couple weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
You're the only one. Congratulations.
I don't know if it was on Susie's class. It was during the day, so yeah. I think it might have been on Susie Larson's thing, or it might have been Connecting Faith.
Connecting Faith.
I remember when he said that the root of all addiction is isolation.
Right. Wrong relationship. Yep.
And it kind of it clicked in my head because I belong to Clutters Anonymous.
Oh, sure.
I've been in Al-Anon 33 years. Okay. I've been in Clutters Anonymous about a year and a half, and people will go, well, why go to a meeting? You're just wasting your time. Why don't you just stay home and clean?
Right. Isn't that amazing? It's like they keep wanting to solve the problem instead of solving the disease. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And the other thing is that I think almost every clutterer at their core has a deep fear that if they did clean their house and get rid of all their precious stuff that they've been using kind of as a hedge because they can't get what they really want, that these people who promise to love them if they just get rid of it, that they'll find some other reason not to care about them.
Right. See, I think you're almost right about that, but it's actually even one step deeper than that. They're afraid it'll be true.
Mm-hmm.
So your love really was conditional. Now that I've cleaned it all up, now you like me? That would actually be scary to find out, wouldn't it?
Very scary.
And so it's almost easier to not get there because then you never really quite have to put that to the test.
Well, and you know, all those clutter shows on TV, the hoarder shows?
Right.
At almost all of them, at the end, the child usually still rejects the parent.
Right, because it's important to understand this. The parent is, or whoever it is that's holding on to that stuff, they hold on to it because, see, in the game of tag, there are two things I'm afraid of, intimacy and decisions. Intimacy, if I let someone get close to me, I'm going to get hurt. If I make a decision, what if it's wrong? What if I screwed up? Blah, blah, blah. So if you talk to any hoarder, you'll find somebody who's really, really afraid to make decisions because if I have 1,000 things in my house and I need to clean up my house, that's 1,000 decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm afraid of making decisions, yeah, that's a scary thought.
Mm-hmm. Very scary.
Well, thank you very much for calling into the show. Did you have anything else you wanted to add or ask?
I also wanted to say that several years ago when I was sick after my son was born, when my friends from my 12-step group came to visit me in the hospital, it was a real turnaround. I got a lot healthier.
Right. Suddenly you knew you weren't alone. It's powerful.
Yeah, very powerful.
Yep. I honestly think you'll see this. Every story with Jesus heals somebody. See, healing always happens in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So, right, you're powerfully connected. There's a healing that happens. And I think, you know, God bless your group for coming.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thanks for being on the show. If you just stay on the line, we'll make sure we get you one of Glenn's books.
Assuming we can get one away from Bill.
Yeah, you have to get my copy. I've already dog-eared several of the pages. But thanks for coming on tonight's show.
Hey, thanks for watching both shows. That was great.
Thank you.
Well, that was nice. So we're not in this alone, and the way to get out of our problem is maybe the first step is to recognize that and get into action. So if I'm struggling with my relationships, which everybody is, and we're not terminally unique, what would you recommend as a good starting point for somebody listening tonight that's going, hey, you know, this is really hitting home for me. Now what do I do? What's an action plan?
Thank you very much. So Jesus said we're supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves. And whether you're the addictive person or the codependent person, that's a powerful sentence, and here's how come. If you're addictive, you need to hear you're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself instead of only yourself. Because if an addictive person is so focused on their own gap, their own lack, their own pain, that it makes them really self-absorbed.
Could you say that again, please, for me?
Yes.
Okay.
An addictive person is, by definition, self-absorbed. So aware of their pain, so desperate to get enough money, sex, achievement, who knows what, to fill that pain, that it makes them really self-absorbed. And so Jesus says to them, I want you to love your neighbor as hard as you keep trying to love yourself. Now, to the codependent person in that same sentence, see, codependent people think Jesus said you're supposed to love your neighbor instead of yourself. But he didn't say that either. So whether you're the addictive part of the equation or the codependent part of the equation, you need to hear that sentence. Our job is to love our neighbor as ourselves.
Wow.
Yeah, you look a little stunned there, George.
I was thinking, you know, like, let's say a guy asks you a question and you don't give a good enough answer, so he says something mean to you and ignores you.
Yeah, I know.
Do
that's,
I still
that's
love
just mean-spirited, isn't it?
I still love him.
Hypothetically. Oh, look, there's another caller. Bill from Minneapolis. Go ahead, Bill. You're on here.
Don't take this call. I thought we banned him.
Go ahead, Glenn.
He'll call back.
He'll call back, trust me.
Well, so I want to say this then, just, you know, because Alex was talking about just taking one day at a time, which, of course, is sort of the mantra of the whole 12-step program, to take one day at a time. And, of course, Jesus said the same thing, you know, why be anxious about tomorrow? You know, be focused on today. And I come to realize it's for this very, very specific reason, because God only exists in the present. So when Moses encounters God in the burning bush and God says, no, go tell the people this, and Jesus is like, who am I going to say sent me? Like, nobody's going to listen to me. And God says, I am. Sent you. God lives in a powerful, eternal right now. Therefore, unless I'm also in the right now, I'm not actually walking with our Lord.
Well, George, you and I have the collective IQ of a border collie, which I'm not saying is...
they're a fairly smart animal.
They're a fairly smart animal.
Very loyal.
But I feel real dumb tonight. I don't know about you.
I was just thinking, you know, we don't have to think that much on this show.
Not tonight.
You know.
But I do think we need to take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to have more with Dr. Glenn Bickering. And feel free to call in the program if you'd like. We've got another book to give away. This is Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Fraser on Faith Radio. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Where else on Sunday night would you like to be except right here with us, the two guys cleverly disguised as radio professionals, Bill Arnold and George Fraser. We're here with Dr. Glenn Bickering. And right before we went to break, we were talking about how to get things started. Glenn, and do you have a way to finish that comment off?
Yes, I'd be so glad to. Thank you. I think when Jesus said, we're supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves, he was trying to give us a bit of a blueprint. So it's important to ask us, each one of us, to ask ourselves, what are the things that make me feel cared for? What are the things that make me feel nurtured? What are the things that make me feel like I matter? What are the things that help me remember that I'm precious to our Lord? Who are the people, when I'm with them, I feel stronger, clearer, better, cared for? And the clearer I can get in my mind about the things that have that powerful effect on me, the clearer my list is about how I want to start treating all the people in my life.
That's great.
That's really great. So we have another caller. I think, are they still on the line? They're gone. We had an email question in tonight that said they didn't want to be on the air necessarily, but had a question. A friend is addicted to pain pills, seems to be sleeping his life away, does not know how to handle the situation, but it's so frustrating. What in the world should she do?
That's a darn good question.
Yeah.
And I'm going to answer that in a way that seems a little analytical, I promise, at first, but I promise I'll come right back to it. Frustration is exactly the right word. We tend to use anger and frustration as if they're interchangeable, but anger means somebody has done something to me that was hurtful. Frustration means there's something I want and I can't find a way to get it. And so here she is with this friend. She wants desperately to be able to be care for that person, to nurture that person, to be of help to that person, can't find a way to do it, and that is frustrating, painful. And I noticed this. So the rich young ruler comes to Jesus, asks how can he inherit eternal life. Jesus kind of blows him off, gives him the list of commandments. The man says, I've done all those. And Jesus says, well, great. Because he leaves out one. He only actually tells him nine things of the Ten Commandments. He He skips the one on coveting. And he says, well, great, give away all your stuff. Come and follow me and do ministry with us, and that'll be really amazing. And the man walks away. And I notice that Jesus lets him. And I notice how often he says things like, he who has ears, let him hear. And so if I have a friend who's struggling, I need to tell my friend the truth. I need to care for them. I need to nurture them. I need to be present to them. I need to tell them how concerned I am. I need to be as much as I can an invitation to them to be better. But I need to understand at the end of the day, I can be an invitation, but I can't be a command.
Very, very interesting.
I really like that. There's no ultimatum there, is there?
Right, there's no ultimatum.
So we don't end the relationship based on what you do.
Absolutely not, because then it's like, see, what I'm saying is, unlike Jesus, it's like, no, I want to tell you the truth and make sure that you do it. And at that point, see, I slip into that controlling thing.
Mm-hmm. Glenn, the people that struggle with addictions, they find themselves usually in places of rage and self-hatred and anxiety.
Right.
And obviously the collateral damage that comes along with people that they love and that they're in relationships with is oftentimes manifested with very inappropriate behavior. And
right.
And what recommendation can you bring to these people in terms of managing their own sanity in this environment?
I mean, the people who are related to those.
Yes.
People. You're not going to like it. This is how I lose almost all my clients.
Cool.
I have a pastoral counseling practice in Eden Prairie. And they don't like to hear that every relationship's 50-50. So when Jesus said, why do you see the speck in your brother's eye? You can't see the log in your own eye. If I have somebody in my life who is really upsetting to me and I am in a really wrong relationship with that person, it's really, really easy to focus on the crazy, outlandish, destructive things they might be doing. But if I'm going to take Jesus' advice seriously, I really need to start with the question, what's my half of this process? Because I promise you I have half of it, or else I wouldn't be in it. And unless I'm going to take a stand about my half, nothing's ever going to change.
I'm really interested in the aspect of passive tag.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to Dr. Glenn Pickering, and he's written a book on the game of tag. It's the world's most common game, he claims, and I believe it. And he also has encouraged us tonight to look at the fact that it's the game itself is the cause of every sort of kind of addictive behavior. But I'm always fascinated because I'm kind of a withdraw guy, and I find it easy sometimes to withdraw because I think it's just going to cause less pain in the moment,
mm-hmm.
even though I'm loading the cannon for some time later.
Right. And I promise you that's true of every addictive behavior. And I don't mean that sarcastically to you, although
I'd like
to tease you.
But, go ahead.
What I mean is this. Let's say I'm an alcoholic guy and I'm down at the bar and I don't have any actual guy friends. Okay. So I could spend the rent money tonight buying drinks for people so they'll pat me on the back and tell me what a great guy I am. And tomorrow, of course, they won't know my name. Or I could spend 6 months joining the church, going to my guy's Bible study, meeting other men in my neighborhood, joining up with some community effort of some sort, really, really starting to build real relationships with real men, and that will take time. So
mm-hmm.
am I going to spend the rent money tonight, or am I going to actually start making real friends? And I promise you, every single one of us, if we want to break out of our compulsive or addictive behaviors, we need to ask ourselves, if I was going to quit looking for the short-term solution to this and instead look for the long-term, actually constructive solution to whatever it is I'm doing, what would that look like?
People in addictions usually never want to look at the long-term solution.
Right.
They're too obsessed with short-term satisfaction.
No, I want what I want, and I want it right now.
Right, which is why oftentimes if you talk to addictive people for very long, you'll be struck by the childishness of their behavior.
Ouch.
Yeah. I'm looking at them.
Childish behavior.
Right, because that's what a child is, right? They can't delay gratification long enough to get what they actually want.
What about the family member that might, or the friend or the person in your life that just sort of physically withdraws and says, basically, if I'm here, you can't tag me?
Right.
Who's the bigger child in that? And what are they trying to accomplish? Are they just so scared? Is fear what's
right.
driving them to do that?
I promise you the entire game is driven by fear. And so, again, back to the 50-50 thing. If I have somebody in my life who does that withdrawal thing, you know, who plays passive tag by what they don't do, then I have to be dead honest with myself because it's very, very likely that I play an active game of tag. And then when I talk to them, I make them feel judged or inferior, or like they just can't do it right, or nothing they ever do is good enough, or somehow they're going to get a bad reaction out of me. And so they have finally decided that the best thing to do is to just quit interacting. And so, yes, I want to encourage them to talk to me, but my 50 of that is I have to come to them, and again, back to making amends, to say, hey, you know what, I get it. I've been critical. I've made it feel not safe to you to talk to me. And I'm committing myself to doing my half of this relationship differently, and I invite you into a different kind of relationship with me.
Okay, I have an amends question. So if you're making an amends,
yes,
and let's say you're making an amends to me, are you interested at all in knowing what my amends language is, or is this about you? Let's say, for example, you borrow my car, you don't put any gas in it, and you leave Burger King stuff in the back seat. I'm saying this as an example because
why would anybody borrow your car?
This is what George did to me.
I've seen that Prius, and so it's hard to believe.
Here we go. Thank you very much. Lime green Prius.
And maybe you say to me, "Hey, sorry, I didn't put gas in it."
Right.
And I go, "You know, that doesn't work for me. No, that actually doesn't satisfy me at all."
No, here's how come. My wife and I do a really powerful weekend seminar for a Christian couple. It's called Living the Truth. And one of the things we talk about is forgiveness, which is really just a way of talking about amends. And we have come to really, really understand if I'm asking for somebody's forgiveness, I'm not asking them to forgive my behavior. I'm asking them to forgive the impact I had on them. So let's say, for example, when I do counseling sessions all day, my sessions go from 10 after the hour to the hour. So let's say I'm supposed to meet somebody at 2:10. Okay. So I come out there at 2:12 to get them, and they're there. I will say, I'm sorry I kept you waiting. And I am sorry I kept them waiting. Now, let's say I get out there at 2:12, and they're not there yet. But they do arrive at 2:15. Do I apologize to them then for having been late? No, because it didn't have an impact on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, see, the problem with somebody who just said, oh, sorry, I didn't do the gas, is, see, they're not taking long enough to actually understand the impact that their behavior had on you. And so the problem with making amends and the way most people understand it from a worldly perspective is they think we're apologizing for our behavior. But we need to understand we need to be apologizing for the impact that our behavior had on the other person. And so our first question should actually be about the impact that we had on them so that we know what to apologize for.
Can I be sorry for my behavior as well?
Nope, because it doesn't matter. Let's say, for example, I'm really sarcastic, just hypothetically. And let's say I do that with my little brother, Lee, who's incredibly funny, I think, and who laughs hysterically when I give him crap. Now, so I go home to my wife, and I say those same things, and she looks at me really hurt and says, why would you say those things to me? Now, as my daughter says, women aren't funny. Now, but, see, and even then, I'm not apologizing for being sarcastic. I'm apologizing for the fact that my sarcasm, my thoughtlessness, my failure to remember that she is affected in a different way by that than other people had that impact on her and made her feel like I didn't matter to her. That's what I'm apologizing for. Because if she thought it was funny, I wouldn't be apologizing.
Okay. But if my behavior violates my moral code,
mm-hmm.
just because you're not offended by that.
Not offended, affected.
Okay, affected by that.
But I am.
What if I'm still sorry about that? Why couldn't I apologize for that?
Because you can't do something that violates your true self without affecting everybody around you, which is what, when we do an intervention, that's what we're all talking about, right? Your behavior has had an impact on me. Your violation of your true self will always impact all of the people in your life.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That helped clear things up for you, George?
I'll listen to the tape tomorrow. You know, this is very deep. Heady stuff for me, Bill, in that, you know, we get sober and we're working on, you know, walking with God. And some of the things that we're talking about tonight, got to be honest, I really haven't thought of on this level before. So I can imagine it's probably, you know, for people listening the same way. And obviously, we got to have Glenn back on the show.
And that's my friend, why we had Glenn on the show tonight. And we have asked him if he would consider being a recurring guest on the show. And sort of a regular kind of wisdom and oracle of truth and understanding. And he said yes.
Well, I think that's great because we always say that the real barometer on how good my recovery is going is how well my relationships are.
Right. And that's not a barometer. That's just the actual measure.
All right, that wraps up our show for tonight. I am so glad that everybody joined us tonight. Thanks for being with us. Have a great week. Good night, and God bless.